Although the new Republican governor says he's going to try to stop that.
Well, you know, the civil rights song is freedom is a constant struggle. So we got to continue to push. But what a tremendous message the voters in Florida sent by passing that amendment.
And Derek Johnson, we're going to have to leave it there. But I thank you so much for being with us, President and CEO of the NAACP. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
So this is Christmas.
On Monday, December 24th, Prison Pipeline hosts will feature your holiday messages to your loved ones in prison, as well as greetings from prisoners for those on the outside. Email your message to kbooppc@gmail.com or snail mail your holiday message to KBOO, Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Then tune in on Monday, December 24th at 6:30 p.m. Again, that's kbooppc@gmail.com or mail KBOO Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. And happy holidays from the Prison Pipeline Collective every Monday evening at 6:30 p.m.
Yo. Yo. KBOO is excited to be part of the 2018 Willamette Week Give Guide. This year, Willamette Week and KBOO are challenging our community to give with their dollars and take action by showing up in real life. KBOO has been showing up for over 50 years.
Give to KBOO today and you get full access to the Chinook Book app, plus freebies from Laughing Planet, Gluten-Free Gem, Wii Press, and Nosa Familia Coffee. You can contribute right now at kboo.fm/give
or call 503-231-8032.
Support KBOO,
where music makes the movement.
And you're and you're listening to KBOO Portland, K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and this is the KBOO Local News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Trump tweets out his defense secretary.
Refugees will be forced back across the U.S. border.
And in international news, war and Ebola rage in the Congo.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 20th, 2018. I'm Teresa Mitchell.
And I'm Annette Newell. A Hillsborough man has pleaded guilty to a federal charge for stealing labor union money. According to the U.S. Attorney in Oregon, 43-year-old John Jason Burgess pleaded guilty today to concealing or destroying labor union records. Court documents say between 2008 and 2016, Burgess served as the president of Local 304, a union representing about 140 employees of Pacific Stainless Products, a manufacturer of stainless steel equipment headquartered in St. Helens. Members fund the union entirely through biweekly dues of $12.50 withheld from their paychecks. As president, Burgess was added to Local 304's bank account in 2011, and he got a debit card for it. At around the same time, Burgess took responsibility for maintaining the union's financial records. Burgess was not authorized to draw any money for his duties as an officer of Local 304. He was fired in January 2016, so he became ineligible to continue as a member or officer of the union. He surrendered his debit card linked to the union's bank account, but did not make available the financial records he'd maintained during his time as president. Burgess admitted to abusing his position to take more than $32,000 in union funds for his personal use. He faces a maximum sentence of 12 months in prison, a $100,000 fine, and 1 year of supervised release. He'll be sentenced in April.
A fierce windstorm brought down trees and power lines in western Washington. About 150,000 homes and businesses lost power as winds gusted to 70 miles per hour. Many roads were closed as tree and power line damage made some spots impassable. This comes just days after a tornado struck the town of Port Orchard in western Washington. Water was getting into people's homes on Three Crabs Road, forcing residents to evacuate. North of Seattle, Interstate 5 was closed this afternoon when downed power lines blocked the freeway near Burlington, according to the Associated Press. About 75 miles north of Seattle, downed trees and power lines forced the Washington State Department of Transportation to close the Deception Pass Bridge in Oak Harbor. Many schools closed, including Winlock School District in Lewis County, due to a power outage. Even the National Weather Service office in Seattle was itself struggling. The forecasters there tweeted that they were depending on backup generator power after the storm knocked out their power. After about 300 flights were delayed from Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. The wind ripped off part of the St. Joseph Clock Tower in Bellingham, Washington. Luckily, there have not been any reports yet of injuries. Gusty winds are expected through tonight.
Gray whales are on the move south this December, so the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department is celebrating the migration with the annual Whale Watching Week, December the 27th through the 31st. Volunteers from the Whale Watching Spoken Here program will be at 24 sites along the Oregon coast during this event. From 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. each day, they'll offer whale watching tips and facts about the animals. You can even find a map of the whale watch sites on the website whalespoken.org. Every winter, about 20,000 gray whales migrate south from Alaska to the warm calving lagoons off the coast of Baja, Mexico. Whale Watching Week coincides with the highest frequency of whales swimming down the coast. About 30 whales pass by per hour. Luke Parsons, an OPRD ranger with the Whale Watching Center, says the goal is to create awareness and compassion for whales and other marine life. Whales are a special part of the Oregon coast, he said. We're very proud to work with our volunteers to help visitors connect with the whales and our oceans.
And now, headlines and stories.
The Public Health Service Daily Newscast for Thursday, December the 20th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. President Trump goes against some in the Pentagon in a move to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria. Also on the Thursday rundown, criminal justice reform will benefit people with disabilities. Plus, we'll tell you about a lawsuit aimed at the red tide plaguing the Sunshine State. Topping our news, President Donald Trump has ordered a rapid withdrawal of all 2,000 U.S. ground troops from Syria within 30 days. The New York Times reports Trump is declaring the four-year American-led war against the Islamic State as largely won. Quoting his Twitter feed, Trump said, "We have defeated ISIS in Syria, my only reason for being there during the Trump presidency." The Times notes the president offered no details on his plans for the military mission nor a larger strategy in Syria. They add that Pentagon officials had sought to talk the president out of the decision as late as Wednesday morning, arguing that such a move would betray Kurdish allies who fought alongside American troops in Syria and now could find themselves under attack in a military offensive threatened by Turkey. The criminal justice reform bill making its way through the Congress will help thousands of people with disabilities re-enter their communities. Andrea Sears explains.
According to the Bureau of Justice, 32% of people in federal prisons and 40% of all people in jail in the United States have at least one disability. The First Step Act, passed by the Senate on Tuesday, would expand job training and early release programs and reduce minimum mandatory sentences for nonviolent offenders incarcerated in federal prisons. Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi, president of the group Respectability, says those reforms will help thousands of people with disabilities successfully leave incarceration.
It means they'll be able to go back into the community and hopefully get a job, have their talents used in the community, and to have a better future.
Leadership in the House says it will pass the bill this week, and President Donald Trump has said he will sign it into law.
Only 61% of young people with disabilities graduate from high school, compared with 81% of those without a disability. And at a rally at the State House in Boston this week, a coalition announced its plans for new legislation to ensure more funding for public schools and for colleges.
The Fund Our Future Coalition says schools have been underfunded for years and wants the Massachusetts legislature to increase the public education budget by $1.5 billion. Zach Bears is executive director of PHENOM, the Public Higher Education Network of Massachusetts, a coalition member. Bears says people from a variety of backgrounds came to the State House on Tuesday.
We had a packed room at the State House, and we had strong speakers, K-12 students, higher ed students, teachers, parents, community leaders, all saying the same thing, that we need to fund our future and we need to do it now.
The $1.5 billion amount is based on recommendations of two state commissions in 2014 and 2015, suggesting even more than that is needed for K-12 and higher education. Coalition members say if the Fair Share Amendment, or millionaire's tax, had been on the November ballot and had passed, it likely would have made up for the funding shortfall. I'm Laura Ross-Brautelum reporting.
The Fund Our Future Coalition includes the Massachusetts Teachers Association, the American Federation of Teachers of Massachusetts, Boston Teachers Union, and the NAACP New England Area Conference, among others. The Michigan House of Representatives passed several bills on Wednesday that senior groups say will improve health care across the state.
Two bills introduced by Representative Jim Tedder would make Michigan the 25th state to sign on to the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact. Melissa Seifert with AARP Michigan says that will allow doctors from other states to be licensed to practice in Michigan, increasing access to health care for everyone.
This means better access to quality care for individuals, most likely for the use of telehealth and telemedicine.
According to the American Hospital Association, 65% of hospitals now have some form of telemedicine, often where a physician meets with the patient via video conference. The Citizen Research Council of Michigan has said the state will need 12% more primary care physicians by the year 2030. I'm Suzanne Potter.
The bills go to Governor Rick Snyder's desk for his signature and would take effect 90 days later. Finally, Tramell Gomes is reporting environmental groups are concerned that Florida's persistent red tide outbreaks are being fueled by authorized polluted discharges from Lake Okeechobee.
The Center for Biological Diversity, Colusa Waterkeeper, and Waterkeeper Alliance have teamed up to challenge the Army Corps of Engineers, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the National Marine Fisheries Service. The groups claim the agencies have ignored harm to wildlife and say plans to continue opening the dam for toxic flows through 2025 should end. Jacqueline Lopez with the Center for Biological Diversity says the Army Corps is treating rivers like a toilet.
The practice of flushing the polluted water from Lake Okeechobee down the Caloosahatchee in St. Lucie has got to stop. We need to understand what the impact is from these discharges.
Wednesday's notice gives the agency 60 days to respond to the claims. In July, the Army Corps approved a plan to build a reservoir south of Lake Okeechobee to reduce the toxic discharges.
Spokespeople for the Wildlife and Fisheries Services have said the agencies do not comment on pending lawsuits. A message requesting comment was left in the Corps.
Hurricane Michael was the third most intense Atlantic hurricane to make landfall in the contiguous United States history. It devastated the community of Panama City, Florida on October 10th of this year. But what you may not know is that the effort to recover for survivors got a lot tougher just last week. On December 11th, a large tent city in the parking lot of a church transformed into a demolition site. Police cleared out the hurricane survivors and their belongings. Joining us now live from Florida is Jimmy Dunson, a volunteer coordinator with Mutual Aid Disaster Relief. I'm Teresa Mitchell. I'm here with Annette Newell. Welcome and thank you for joining us on KBOO News in Depth. Jimmy, first, tell us what Mutual Aid Disaster Relief is.
Mutual Aid Disaster Relief is a people-powered disaster relief network based on the principles of solidarity, mutual aid, and autonomous direct action. And we work with communities, especially their most marginalized members, to recover and take care of each other.
What can you tell us about what happened to the hurricane survivors on December 11th?
All right. So people had already been displaced because of illegal evictions from apartment buildings all throughout the greater Panama City area. And on December 11th, many people suffered from a second eviction. People were living out of their trucks, out of tents, out of travel trailers. and the Panama City Police and the Alabama West Florida Conference of the United Methodist Church overseed an eviction where they went tent to tent, you know, vehicle to vehicle, and under the threat of arrest, the police gave people about a 3-hour notice, you know, to vacate the property or else be arrested, and you know, people had nowhere to go. The only help that many people were offered by the authorities at the church was a bus ride to Pensacola, where they could stay at a $10 a night shelter there. And most people just packed up what they could and walked away, either pushing shopping carts or carrying what was on their backs. We drove many people, you know, we helped people pack up their belongings and drove people, you know, somewhere else, you know, anywhere else. And, you know, while doing this, while documenting this, many of our volunteers were trespassed from the property as well.
What's been described so far, from what I've read, has a rather punitive tone, and it would seem that the people are being treated as if they are trespassers or some sort of insurgents rather than internally displaced persons from a natural disaster. So I was surprised to hear about that. I thought the story would be one of FEMA trailers, et cetera. The eviction itself was overseen by a conference of the United Methodist Church. Did that surprise you?
Definitely. You know, yes, we hoped, you know, folks would have empathy and kindness and, you know, act with, you know, concern for people who have nowhere to go. And what we didn't see that. We saw a callousness, and it was very heartbreaking to see. Contrary to reports otherwise, there were families, you know, still present. You know, there was a family with 8 children who they got back from school to see a bulldozer destroying their tent, and that's just really unacceptable, and it's uncalled for.
Mm-hmm. Jimmy, you mentioned the police talked to the church officials, then they told the people by loudspeaker they had just 3 hours to pack up all their belongings. How many people were affected by this?
There was about 100 people who were displaced from the eviction of Tent City. And it was combined people who were internally displaced from Panama City, from other neighborhoods in Panama City because of Hurricane Michael, and also other folks who came into town to do the work of recovery, of, you know, fixing roofs and doing the labor to rebuild and recover from the storm.
I noticed that President Trump, when he feels like it, has no qualms about deploying troops on U.S. soil, but there are no troops there, from what I've heard. Certainly no construction battalions present to build homes. What is your group doing to help the hurricane survivors now? Are you working with the FEMA, or is the FEMA even there?
We work directly with impacted community members, and we prioritize listening and going from there. So we listen, we ask questions, and then we respond to whatever the self-determined needs of impacted individuals and communities are. So this in Panama City after Hurricane Michael, it's turned into, you know, help getting folks prescriptions or medical assistance. It's been resisting illegal evictions and connecting people with lawyers. It's been tarping roofs or clearing debris or cutting down branches that hang precariously over people's homes, or you know, sorting supplies, distributing supplies, you know, whatever needs arise. You know, we're flexible to be able to respond to whatever that may be.
Of those 100 people, where are they now? Are they back in safe housing, or do you know? Is it even possible to know?
No. We you know, we're scrambling, you know, that day and since, you know, trying to get people into whatever temporary housing, you know, is possible. And a lot of folks are still don't have anywhere to go, or living, you know, precariously in a tent behind someone's house and hoping they don't get found, or, you know, living, you know, in a tent at a graveyard, or, you know, just staying behind a CVS, or, you know, some people have went as far as Tallahassee or Pensacola to homeless shelters because, you know, that was the only thing available for them.
Some of the people need medication. Some have families. Some were elderly. Could you tell me possibly about one family or even one person who might illustrate what the situation is like?
Sure. So one person, he knew, you know, there are threats of eviction, you know, going on in the camp, you know, for days, although nobody was clear about when it would be. And this one man was, he had a lot of medical issues. He had upper respiratory issues and dehydration, and he was very sick. He couldn't hold down any food or water. And we gave him some medication, but he really needed to get to the hospital. But he couldn't, he didn't want to go to the hospital because he knew if he went, chances are when he came back, everything he owned would be gone. Because of the eviction, and so he waited, and, you know, he was right, you know, the eviction did happen, and so we were able to get some of his supplies, some of his belongings, and get it, you know, somewhere stowed safely. But also during this whole time with the eviction happening, he had a heightened anxiety and panic, and eventually he was able to get to a hospital, and we helped find him some temporary shelter, but he's still in a precarious living situation, you know, going from day to day, not knowing if he's gonna, you know, have a roof over his head. And this is just, you know, one example. There's a ton of other people who, you know, came back later that day, you know, from work or school, just to see, you know, their you know, life-saving medications, their, you know, families, you know, important documents and things like that. You know, being, you know, already bulldozed into a heaping pile of trash. And, you know, they would search through it to try to find what they could salvage. And it was a very, you know, traumatic situation for everybody who experienced it.
You know, in at least one case, the parents came home to find all their belongings bulldozed into garbage. Do they have any legal recourse now?
Not that I know of. I hope we can do something, you know, for these folks to have a sense of justice, or at least, you know, for the light of what happened to be, you know, to come, what happened to come to light. It's a very profoundly, you know, disturbing and sad experience that everybody had to experience, even after the already existing trauma and post-traumatic stress of Hurricane Michael.
What can people do if they want to help?
Well, with Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, you know, we're a people-powered response effort. And we depend on, you know, volunteers to do this type of work. And so if people want to, you know, learn more about us, you can go to mutualaiddisasterrelief.org. Very visceral, powerful example of suffering and oppression and injustice in the context of a disaster. But there's also invisible disasters that happen under our noses in every community all around this country. And we can be forming mutual aid programs in all of our communities to respond to things like extreme poverty and illegal evictions and, you know, hunger and homelessness, you know, and in our own home communities, as well as responding to people's needs after a disaster.
Very true. Thank you so much for joining us, Jimmy. Jimmy Dunson is a volunteer coordinator with Mutual Aid Disaster Relief.
Thank you so much, Jimmy. Doctors fighting the Ebola outbreak are concerned that it will spread south from the town of Beni in the Democratic Republic of Congo into regional transportation hubs. The publication Stat, quoting a World Health official, says should the outbreak spread more widely in cities like Butembo, where there have already been a number of cases, or Goma, a major center further south, the scale of the outbreak could tax the available supplies of an experimental vaccine being used to help contain its spread. An annual poll conducted by the Thomas Reuters Foundation named the war on an Ebola outbreak in Congo as the most neglected crisis of 2018. Reuters quoted Jan Engeland of the Norwegian Refugee Council saying, "The brutality of the conflict is shocking. The national and international neglect, outrageous." Meanwhile, vaccine supplies are running low. As of last Sunday, more than 42,000 doses had been used in the latest outbreak.
New research in the Fukushima radioactive disaster zone has found 180 teenagers with thyroid cancer. As of November, the total of dead or missing from the earthquake and the tsunami stood at 434 people, 400,000, according to the Japanese National Police Agency. In addition, more than 3,600 people from the area died from causes like illnesses and suicide linked to the aftermath of the tragedy, according to the Japanese government data. More than 73,000 people are still displaced. The accident at the nuclear power station in 2011 has also raised grave concerns about radioactive material released into the local environment, the adjoining bay, and the Pacific Ocean, including worries about the radiation-induced thyroid cancer. Ultrasound screenings for thyroid cancer were conducted at the Fukushima Health Management Survey. The observational study group included about 300,000 people aged 18 or younger at the time of the accident. The story relied on two rounds of ultrasound screening during the first 5 years after the accident. Among surgically removed tumors, the overwhelming common diagnosis was papillary thyroid cancer, 149 out of 152 cases.
A week after 7-year-old Jaclyn Maquin died of dehydration in Border Patrol custody, the Trump administration is trying to make things harder for refugees. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen said today that the Trump administration will force certain asylum seekers to remain in Mexico during the course of their asylum hearings. Aliens trying to game the system to get into our country illegally will no longer be able to disappear into the United States, where many skip their court dates, she said, following the Trump administration's rhetoric painting refugees as sneaks. Instead, she said, they will wait for an immigration court decision while they're in Mexico. Nielsen is expected to face a grilling from Congress over the death of the young girl, and the Trump anti-immigrant program took a blow from the courts yesterday as the U.S. Justice Department struck down a guidance statement from former Attorney General Jeff Sessions that denied the possibility of asylum to people escaping domestic violence. Judge Emmett Sullivan of the U.S. District Court for D.C. called Sessions' rule horrible and said the new credible fear policies are arbitrary, capricious, and in violation of the immigration laws. Meanwhile, the president has pressed Congress to provide $5 billion for a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border, but a measure passed in the Senate Wednesday keeps funding flat and only devotes $1.3 billion to barriers.
President Trump again directing national policy by Twitter announced the departure of his defense secretary this afternoon. Trump's message said, quote, "General Jim Mattis will be retiring with distinction at the end of February after having served my administration as Secretary of Defense for the past 2 years," end quote. Mattis was known for more of a steady hand in maintaining U.S. foreign policy, and his departure opened speculation as to whether some more hard-line policies will follow after he leaves in February. The Washington Post wrote that Mattis, quote, "again and again moved to reassure allies unnerved by Trump's unpredictable pronouncements and argued successfully for continued U.S. commitments in Syria, Afghanistan, and other places where military leaders see an ongoing threat," end quote. With the impending withdrawal of U.S. troops in Syria in the news, Mattis leaving may mean that Trump intends to focus less on Iran's oil and manufacturing as a threat to regional profits. In a letter to the president, General Mattis said, quote, "Because you have the right to have a Secretary of Defense whose views are better aligned with yours on these and other subjects, I believe it is right for me to step down from my position," end quote. In apparent rebuke to Trump's international abrasiveness, Mattis also said, quote, "One core belief that I have always held is that our strength as a nation is inextricably linked to the strength of our unique and comprehensive system of alliances and partnerships. We cannot protect our interests without maintaining strong alliances and showing respect to those allies," end quote.
Melissa McKinney's, a Ferguson activist, has made an official claim for her son's brutal death. 24-year-old Donye Jones was found murdered. These next accounts are very gruesome. Please take note of this trigger warning. Donye Jones was found dead. His cause was specified as lynching in front of his own home. Graphic photos were shared through social media from Jones' family, who found him. Melissa McKinney stated, quote, "They lynched my baby. I'm sick and losing my mind, but I had to let the world know what they did to my baby." Some activists have said that this account of a mother finding her son dead from a gruesome death reminds many of the death of Emmett Till. The NAACP stated, quote, "The St. Louis County NAACP is joining the McKinney's family in the call for transparency and justice regarding the murder of Donye Jones. There's too many unanswered questions that we're demanding answers to. We support Mrs. McKinney's call for justice and transparency in the death of her son." McKinney's has also said that she believes her son is dead due to her activism.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast devoted to Native American news, issues, and culture.
With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes in for Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs failed to address accounts of verbal abuse, bullying, and even physical intimidation carried out by former BIA Director Brian Rice during his short 6 months in the post. That's according to a report by High Country News that received documents from the Department of Interior's Office of Inspector General. They pertain to Rice's tenure at the agency and shed light on his sudden departure last April. The news organization says 4 out of 6 complaints were the subject of 3-month investigations. 2 complaints were documented and closed. There's no record of officials in the Interior Department taking any action to address the alleged behavior. Last March, several media outlets reported BIA Freedom of Information Officer Jessica Rogers sent an email to tribal leaders calling Rice, a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, quote, "an insidious perpetrator of harassment." She detailed an incident inside the Washington, D.C. headquarters in which she met Rice face-to-face for the first time and claims Rice acted aggressive and intimidating. Rogers told High Country News that reporting Rice's behavior to his superiors only made the situation worse, and the inappropriate actions are carried throughout the agency. The allegations of harassment are only one of the many troubling accounts that plagued the agency run by Ryan Zinke, who announced over the weekend he's stepping down. Tribal leaders and lawmakers are watching for any progress on legislation known as Savannah's Act when the U.S. House of Representatives convenes again this week. The bill was unanimously approved in the Senate, but has yet to be introduced in the House. The bill was authored by outgoing North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp. It aims to improve communication among federal, local, and tribal law enforcement agencies, give tribes better access to criminal databases, and issue regular reports on activities among jurisdictions. It's named for Savannah Marie Graywind, who was murdered last year in Fargo. Heitkamp, a Democrat who lost a re-election bid in November, blames the holdup in the House on Representative Bob Goodlatte, a Republican from Virginia. In a tweet last month, Heitkamp said Goodlatte is playing petty politics. Goodlatte has not spoken publicly about the issues with the bill. Goodlatte is retiring from his seat at the end of this term. The Republican candidate defeated in her bid for a congressional seat from New Mexico says further legal action to contest the election is possible. State Representative Yvette Harrell narrowly lost the election in November to Democrat Xochitl Torres-Small for the state's second congressional seat. Harrell is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, but did not mention her native heritage during the campaign. Harrell was ahead in the vote count when the counting stopped election night, but she lost her lead as election officials started counting absentee ballots they hadn't gotten to yet. Harrell has yet to concede the election. On her Facebook page, Harrell said her team is looking into various reports of inconsistencies in the results, which she says are needed to ensure the integrity of the election. A judge allowed her campaign to examine the absentee ballots and various other elections documents, a process her legal team has completed. Elections officials maintain all the ballots and procedures are in order. Harrell has until January 6th to contest the results of the election. The Navajo Nation Council delegates are meeting in a 3-day special session beginning Wednesday. Among the issues they intend to tackle is an override of outgoing President Russell Begay's veto of a Veterans Advisory Council bill. The delegates approved the bill in October, changing the role of the veterans group. The council started in 2016 as a panel to recommend policy to the president on veterans affairs. The change switched oversight to the Navajo Nation Council and established a board of commissioners. At the time, Begay said the council failed to get adequate input from all those involved. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is by Odawi Law Group, provider of Indian Law Solutions, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite System.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News for Thursday, December 20th, 2018. Here are the main points again. Trump tweets out his defense secretary. Refugees will be forced back across the U.S. border. And in international news, war and Ebola rage in the Congo. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, so we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. The producers for tonight's newscast are Teresa Mitchell and Annette Newell. Our engineer is Heather McCoy. The director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Teresa Mitchell. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7 is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 o'clock, on Positively Revolting, Ani Raven Haynes will take your calls. At 9 o'clock, Veterans Voice Radio deals with matters of war and peace, health issues, and the after effects of war. At 10, Valley Views talks to a hospice palliative care nurse about the death and end of life care. At 10 o'clock, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on Making Contact, Professor Michael Eric Dyson talks about Trump, truth, and race. All of these KBU programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
For Palestinian rights, after Airbnb rescinded its decision to pull out of West Bank settlements. Joining us live is Rama Kadami from the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, called USCPR in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for being with us here, Rama.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Take us to the beginning here. Back in 2016, we found out that Airbnb was listing properties on Jewish-only settlements. What was your reaction to this?
Yeah, when we found out that Airbnb was allowing settlers to list their properties, these are obviously properties built on land that is stolen from Palestinians, and thus what Airbnb was doing was profiteering off of Israel's brutal military occupation of the Palestinian people in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, including East Jerusalem. We came together with a lot of different partners group under a coalition called the Stolen Homes Coalition to really demand that Airbnb end this practice. This was part of our work around BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, and in response to a Palestinian call that was issued back in 2005 that people of conscience across the globe should use their power as consumers, as investors, to really hold accountable Israel and the institutions allowing Israel to continue its denial of Palestinian rights, accountable for these war crimes, and really push you know, Israel to change its behavior and support freedom, justice, and equality for the Palestinian people. This call obviously mirrors so much what was happened against the as part of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa.
KBOO Radio also officially supports Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. How did USCPR bring groups together to fight this?
So we came together and at first, we launched a petition. Over 150,000 people signed a petition calling on Airbnb to delist these properties, to end their profiteering off of the occupation. We did deliveries of these petitions, so days of actions where we went to Airbnb headquarters in the Bay Area, along with groups that were also struggling against Airbnb and its role in gentrification in so many of our cities in the U.S. and across the globe, and, you know, making the connections that Airbnb in general should not be profiting off of the displacement of people, whether it is the displacement of black and black brown communities here in the United States or the displacement by Israel of Palestinians in Palestine. We also did actions around targeting Airbnb's investors, again, making sure that we're understanding the power we have of people power, of calling, holding not only Airbnb accountable, but also those who are investors in Airbnb, like Fidelity Investments. We did another day of action that corresponded with the anniversary of the occupation to, again, tell Fidelity that to use their leverage with Airbnb. And then we had people coming together. Palestinians would put together videos and actions themselves on the ground, again, showing to Airbnb that we as Palestinians are not even allowed to rent, to be in the settlements, even though they are built on our land, even though the settlers are using our resources. And again, if Airbnb is truly concerned with discrimination and wanting to really put forth that they are a progressive organization concerned with discrimination, this needs to be part of their agenda, and making sure that Israel does not let the fact that Airbnb and other corporations operate in the West Bank, that this is proof that Israel whitewashes Israeli control and how brutal that control is over the Palestinian people in the West Bank.
Now, your group has been working on this for 2 years, and you finally saw some results as of November, right?
Yeah, so last month, Airbnb announced that they were going to be delisting all settlements listings in the West Bank. And I know this week there was a whole, you know, there was a lot of back and forth whether or not they were rescinding. And from our understanding, Airbnb is in fact not rescinding. And I think we need to understand that what the Israeli government really wants to try to push, because this is, you know, slowly BDS has been gaining a lot of ground and has been successful. There's been major corporations changing their behavior due to BDS pressure. A few years ago, we had SodaStream, which sells make your own carbonated soda at home. Mm-hmm. They were forced to shut down their factory in an illegal settlement in the West Bank. The G4S, which is the largest private prison company in the world, was also forced to end their contracts with Israeli prisons, all because of, again, people pressure. Veolia, which used to provide bus line services and garbage services also to the settlements in the West Bank, also had to pull out. And so the Israeli government is feeling a lot of pressure around trying to convince corporations to not actually succumb to BDS pressure and to put this front that they themselves are actually winning and not, in fact, people power is winning, and people who are working in solidarity and in support of the Palestinian people are putting the pressure, actually, and Israel is feeling itself more and more delegitimized and feeling more and self-isolated because people are taking a stand and realizing what is happening is wrong and that this needs to end. And so what we saw this week, I think, is an attempt by Israel to try to convince Airbnb to change their mind, but Airbnb is actually standing still. And I think part of the confusion was that Israel was trying to push its own narrative that they are able to change Airbnb's decision. But in fact, Airbnb is still planning to delist settlements that are in the West Bank, which we plan to hold them accountable to that now that they've announced it. And noting that also to try to push them further, because a statement that was put out by the Boycott National Committee, made clear that there is that Israel's not actually delisting from East Jerusalem, and East Jerusalem itself is also occupied territory. So I think the lesson here is that when we acknowledge what Airbnb did is good, it also is on us to continue pushing Airbnb to actually follow through and pushing them also further in terms of, well, what about East Jerusalem? Or what about, in general, the role you play in gentrification across the world?
One of your tactics was actually to approach Airbnb investors. Do you think that made a big difference?
You know, I think there were so many different tactics that were happening across the globe. So yes, approaching the investors, approaching them directly. We knew, for example, that Human Rights Watch put out a report specifically around Airbnb and Booking, and really shining a light on how a lot of these kind of in general, the travel tourism industry around Israel helps Israel solidify its control over Palestinian land, helps Israel whitewash its war crimes, because people come and they're not even at times realizing that they're actually living, staying in a settlement, because that's part of Israel's point. It wants to blur the line between the settlements and 1948 land itself, what we call historic Palestine, 1948 Palestine. And I think that's the idea around that is, again, that Israel wants to pretend that, you know, they control all of this land, and they want that just to be accepted as fact. And so I think there were a lot of different factors playing around that finally Airbnb felt the pressure, specifically when they recently, about a year ago, put out a statement specifically around them taking stronger stance against discrimination, because they were accused specifically in the United States of their customers and their users being discriminatory against against black and brown communities here in the United States. That then it was like, okay, well, you put out the statement, we're going to hold you to account to your statement that you want to be very, you want to make sure that your platform is not actually providing more space for discrimination.
Mm-hmm. You talk about holding them accountable. Now that Airbnb is pulling out of the settlements, do you believe this issue is really resolved?
I think, again, we have to hold them accountable. We have to make sure they actually follow through. And in general, I think what we should acknowledge with Airbnb is the good example that they are hopefully setting for other corporations. So now that, you know, other corporations, like we said, like with Booking, listen, this is what corporate responsibility can look like, that you can hear people's concerns and act accordingly, and make sure you all following your obligations, whether it's to your own anti-discriminatory policies or in general your human rights policies related to businesses. And I think it's been very clear for decades, and more human rights organizations have put out that doing business in settlements is actually allowing Israel to continue its control of the Palestinian people, and businesses have a duty to end that.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell here with Annette Newell, and we're talking with Rama Kudaimi, Director of Grassroots Organizing for the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Rama, part of the effort is called the Stolen Homes Coalition. Could you tell us what the coalition is and who's involved?
Yeah, so it involved groups, several groups, including Jewish Voice for Peace, the U.S. Palestinian Community Network, Some of Us, American Muslims for Palestine, Friends of Sabil North America, Code Pink. So, again, groups who are really dedicated to Palestinian rights, who are dedicated to economic activism and holding corporations and institutions accountable for how they are profiteering off of Israel's oppression of the Palestinian people.
Are there other businesses that might be doing the same thing in addition to Airbnb?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of, you know, BDS campaigns holding corporations responsible. I mentioned a few in the past, of where we've seen big wins, whether it is SodaStream, Veolia, G4S. Another one that's there's been a lot of action around is HP, so Hewlett-Packard, where Hewlett-Packard and Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, which is, you know, a company that specifically does business with governments. So they used to actually hold, what HPE used to do was support Israel in their denial of freedom of movement for Palestinian people. So used to the ID system that Israel would use to profile Palestinians, to make it more difficult for Palestinians to go through checkpoints, to make it more difficult for Palestinians to go through the apartheid wall that Israel has built to, you know, steal more Palestinian lands. HP also is the main company that provides computers to the Israeli military. So I think it's very, you know, this is why Palestinians, when they put out the call in 2005 for BDS, understanding that unfortunately governments across the globe are not holding Israel accountable, but we as people can hold, you know, can make the move to try to hold Israel accountable. And that includes, again, our power as consumers and investors to make sure we're not investing in these corporations, that we're not buying their products, as well as then actually, you know, working towards making sure our governments are not also providing the military aid that Israel needs. And as I'm sure a lot of your listeners know, the United States provides, you know, $3.8 billion in military aid every single year to Israel. That's the military aid that Israel, the weapons that Israel uses to kill and maim Palestinians. And most recently, we've seen with the Great Return March in Gaza, as Palestinians in Gaza are demanding an end to now the 11-year blockade on them, as well as a return to their homes. 70% of Palestinians in Gaza are actually refugees. And what Israel's response has been has to, you know, kill at least 160 Palestinian marchers, including journalists and medics and men, women, and children of all ages.
Hmm. You know, just about 40 minutes ago, the New York Times says the Trump administration is withdrawing about 7,000 troops from Afghanistan. What do you think about that, as well as the withdrawal of troops from Syria? How is this all going to impact the Middle East?
Yeah, I mean, Trump is, you know, unfortunately, people want to, at times we seem a very desperate for any sort of positive news coming out, and so people want to quickly celebrate things like the withdrawal of troops from whether it's Syria or Afghanistan, and these are things that we should look at and say, okay, you know, we don't want U.S. troops occupying other countries, but what is the big picture here? What does it mean that, you know, if withdrawal of troops is not actually ending U.S. airstrikes, does that really make a difference? Or in Syria, for example, U.S. airstrikes have continued. You know, Obama started bombing Syria in September of 2014, specifically bombing ISIS. So that's part of the war on terror rhetoric that continues, you know, that George Bush launched, but continued under Obama. And actually, Trump has come in and expanded it exponentially. So his first year in office, for example, he completely destroyed Raqqa, Syria, and Mosul, Iraq, as part of his war on ISIS. And no one has really talked about that as much as they should. And yet the attention all went yesterday in terms of, oh, he's withdrawing troops, that's great, but we're not. No one's demanding, well, where's the accountability for the airstrikes? Are these airstrikes even going to end? What is, you know, if troops who themselves are actually not engaged as much in much warfare, and we're actually more there to help protect the Syrian Democratic Forces, who are receiving aid through air power from the United States, and really that was protecting them from now potentially Turkey, which has its own interests in Syria in terms of specifically around Kurdish groups. If they're now getting the green light to kind of go in and unfortunately themselves commit even more war crimes in Syria. So I think we need to really think big pictures, and at times we get really we get sucked into the small little actions that Trump does and not think big picture. Well, is this actually impacting people on the ground positively? And I don't think necessarily the U.S. just pulling 2,000 troops is the positive impact that people think is going to happen.
Do you have comments about the U.S.-Saudi attack on Yemen and the humanitarian crisis there?
Yeah, it's definitely, again, another war that, you know, the U.S. has itself been bombing Yemen, again, since the war on terror was launched under George W. Bush, and then with Obama really providing, giving Saudi Arabia a green light to do their war starting in March 2015, and understanding again how that was connected with Obama's efforts to do an Iran deal, that he felt the need I need to appease both the Saudi Arabia and both Israel with this Iran deal, so I will give Saudi Arabia more weapons, let them do what they want in Yemen. I will give more weapons to Israel, let them do what they want to the Palestinian people. I think what we saw in the last couple of weeks with the Senate taking the vote is a really big step in people showing that no, you know, we need to have say in these wars. We should not be providing military aid to brutal regimes, to commit war crimes against people. So we should not be providing the gasoline, the weapons to Saudi Arabia to be committing these war crimes against the Yemeni people. And I'm hoping this is an opening, not only for people to talk about how the United States is backing other brutal regimes in the region like Israel, but also for us to actually take stock of U.S. war crimes themselves. And I think we're seeing a lot of energy around Trump's and rightful energy and anger around Trump's policies, for example, with wanting to build the wall, his Muslim ban, his violent rhetoric against black and brown and indigenous communities across the country. And that's great. And how do we actually also tackle the fact that since he's been in power, he's also expanded the war on terror? You know, it was under him where he dropped the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan. It's been under him where he's expanded, he's killed even more civilians in Syria, in Iraq, in Libya, in Somalia. Like, these bombings are continuing, and we barely ever talk about them.
Hmm. Tell us more about the group you're involved with, the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, and why you chose personally to get involved with it.
Yeah, so the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, uscpr.org, if people want to check out our website, is a national coalition working together for freedom, justice, and equality. Our work is to really end the U.S. policies that help Israel oppress the Palestinian people, to end support for Israel's apartheid regime for the Palestinian people. We work in solidarity with, like I said, with the call. So our work is BDS campaigns. Our work is changing U.S. policies, such as the military aid to go to Israel that goes to Israel, money that can that obviously makes us morally responsible for what's going on, as well as understanding, like, this is, you know, when people talk about, you know, well, we don't have money for hospitals and schools, well, why, again, are we sending military aid and spending money on war? I think part of our work too is political education. So for folks, we have a curriculum on our website, again, uscpr.org/together we rise, that really talks about the links between the struggle for Palestinian rights and other social justice struggles. So we talk about things like, you know, Black Palestinian solidarity. We talk about how if you're against, you know, Trump's Muslim ban, you also need to be against the fact that Israel bans Palestinian refugees from returning to their homeland. If we're talking about indigenous struggle, and Palestine is an indigenous struggle, you know, when the State of Israel was created in 1948, it was created because as more than 750,000 Palestinians were expelled off of their home. So Palestine is an indigenous struggle, and how we link back to also the United States, and how the creation of the United States actually also meant the genocide of indigenous people, and how both the U.S. and Israel are settler colonial states. And so, you know, we need to understand their relationship also, like, as that they both, you know, they both benefit from this relationship. I think I personally, I grew up, you know, in the suburbs of Chicago. I myself, my family's from Syria, but I grew up with, within a very large Palestinian community in Chicago. And just growing up, you know, you have Palestinian friends who talk about, you know, their inability to visit, to go to their homelands, the fact that their parents and grandparents were kicked out of their homes as children, and the longing to be able to return home and being unable to because Israel, refuses to acknowledge and respect the Palestinian refugees' right of return, and makes it very difficult for any Palestinian to be able to, you know, live in their homeland freely. And I think, you know, that definitely has an impact when you're growing up and hearing these stories of, like, what, you know, what justice looks like, and being wanting to work for that justice.
I noticed that when it comes to coverage of Israel's policies, we hear a lot about Netanyahu, and it seems to me that Likud has dominated the Knesset for so long that it has just disappeared, and people assume that the Likud party is all that there is. Do you have any allies at all in the Knesset? Do you have is the Communist Party helpful? Are there pro-Palestinian factions there?
Yeah, I think what we need to come to realize, I think in general, the issue is itself, you know, Israel's apartheid regime. It's the way it treats Palestinians, whether they are Palestinians who are citizens of Israel but are actually treated like second-class citizens. So on the books, you know, Israel has at least 65 laws that that make it clear that Palestinians are second-class citizens. So when I was talking about Palestinians, you know, not being allowed to return home as refugees, well, there's, you know, Israel has a law of return that, you know, almost any Jewish person in the world can go to Israel and move and live there, while that denies that same right to Palestinians who actually grew up in Palestine. So it's very clear what apartheid is. And then with this past summer, Israel actually passed the nation state law. So this Knesset passed the nation state law that that enshrined and really showed on paper even more clearly what is actually the reality, that in fact Israel is the Jewish state, and excluding anyone who is not Jewish from having the same rights as Jews. And so, you know, no one who has studied Israel or no one who has lived under control as a Palestinian will tell you that they needed this to actually put in law to understand that Israel was an apartheid state. And so while Netanyahu gives us the benefit of Netanyahu being in power, is that, you know, so close with Trump that we can push towards people to say, see, there's a close relationship between Netanyahu and Trump. This is the right-wing agenda. If you are going to be resisting Trump around, you know, his policies on immigration, his policies on climate, his policies around policing, and you're going to be putting yourself out there as resistance to Trump, this needs to be part of your resistance to Trump. We can't be progressive except on Palestine.
I apologize, but I think we're about running out of time here. But thank you so much for joining us for KBOO News in Depth. Rama Kadumi is the Director of Grassroots Organizing for the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, and you can find out more on their website, uspr.org. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you so much.
I'm gathering up skins. I'm gathering up skins and blowing them up like balloons.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Vintage Ska and Rock Steady with Keith and Tex on Saturday, December 22nd from 9 to 11:30 p.m. at the Jack London Review in Portland. Keith Rowe and Philip Texas Dixon are most known for their rock steady hits Stop That Train, Hypnotic Eyes, and Tonight. This event features Keith and Tex, as well as Winston Flames Jarrett and DJ Zach Doe, for this holiday concert. Again, that's Vintage Ska and Rock Steady with Keith and Tex on Saturday, December 22nd from 9 to 11:30 p.m. at the Jack London Review, 529 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland.